Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Ron and Don Show. I'm Don Allen in Studio A, and in Studio B we have the Mr. Ronald A. Edwards. Mr. Edwards, good evening. How are you?
Good evening, Mr. Allen. How are we doing this evening?
We're doing absolutely wonderful.
Okay.
Yeah. We got a couple things going on that we gotta talk about, and tonight, especially we had mentioned earlier in the production meeting about the North Carolina officer has shot that unarmed man. And 10 times,
yeah,
in North Carolina, that's pretty serious. You know, how does something like that happen? And we're talking about the Vikings and also about the gunman and assault in the Navy Yard out in D.C. So
yeah, that's a big ticket one. That's a lot of conversation going on about that. I understand some bloggers are saying was President Barack Obama responsible for this mayhem. That's interesting.
The Black Sphere with Kevin Jackson is saying, is Obama the cause of the mass shootings? There have been 16 mass shootings since Obama became president. Perhaps Obama is the reason behind the epidemic of mass shootings.
Now, but they say 16 mass 16. Shootings?
Yes.
Okay, all right.
Mm-hmm. They have the date sitting here. But Mr. Edwards, what troubles me is that they'll use this particular shooting with Alexis here, Mr. Alexis, to further criminalize African-American males in the United States and to further invoke fear in the hearts of the average citizens that these guys are animals, they're dangerous, they're criminals, and et cetera. And so I'm just watching that pretty close because, you know, we haven't heard anything about Adam Lanza or the Lambert guy or any of those. You know, those guys had mental illness problems. You know, we're going to put them in the hospital and, this guy had a violent, Alexis, they're saying, had a violent history. I was reading some reports online, and pretty ridiculous how the mainstream media is playing this out.
Yeah, well, one should have expected that after the shooting Monday morning at the Naval Yards in Washington, D.C. at approximately 8:30 a.m. And you expect that's coming. I've been saying on these programs and other mediums that it was just a matter of time. The closest they tried to come was at Virginia Tech when a Chinese national who was a student at Virginia Tech killed, 36, 37 individuals, if you will, and what was the most significant carnage since Texas, University of Texas, many years before. So, you know, some of the right wing have been waiting for an event such as this. You know, but the Alex, the Aaron, that situation, they need to be a little careful with that because I'm not quite sure that we're getting all of the pertinent information that is germane to what is happening. The whole thing about his security clearance, the fact that he had a swipe card with him that allowed him to enter the premises, if you will. Obviously, there were no metal detectors, or he knew how to come in without engaging the metal detectors because he at least brought one long gun, as they like to say, either a shotgun or the AR-15 into the facility, if you will. And so there are a lot of questions on my television program to air here Sunday afternoon. I point out the fact that, you know, he's done a lot of extensive traveling overseas. He's a very, very intelligent, or he was, he's now deceased, a very intelligent young man, 34 years of age, a electrical engineer, kind of along the lines of Manning, Private Manning, and Edward Snowden, apparently a real genius with computers.
Yeah.
And real genius with computers. So, you know, it raised some question there. By the way, Don, it's not like that Aaron Alexis did not reach out for help. I mean, we all need to understand that.
Yeah.
Last month he had reached out in Rhode Island. He had called the authorities there and told them that he was hearing voices in his head and, you know, people were tampering and interrupting his rest and sleep with microwaves and et cetera. Those are usually red flags, yet no one apparently notified Hewitt Packard, who was the prime contractor that the subs were working for inside that secure building there. I'm just not quite sure what we really have here, if you will. He was a young man who was studying Buddhism, if you will. Apparently, we're getting ready to find out who had been in the Far East, if you will, in Burma, or, you know, Myanmar, is it called, Thailand, possibly Indonesia, if you will, Japan. Had been involved in a project there in Japan. So, you know, I'm not sure, but let me say this. I want to be sure to get this in because I'm quite sure there'll be a discussion. A large delegation, by the way, from Minnesota is now in Washington, D.C. for the Congressional Black Caucus. Many left out of here, that delegation led by Congressman Keith Ellison, joined by State Senator Jeff Hayden, Louis King, well-known job developer, and et cetera. Alfred Flowers of CSI, Mr. Flowers, one of the group. In fact, as we speak, it's my understanding from sources in Washington, D.C., that Minnesota delegation is meeting at either the Marriott or the Hilton, if you will, large delegation there. Reason this is important that I understand there is discussions going on about the Aaron Alexis situation, what this means, the observation that you made just about 5 minutes ago. Apparently under discussion, I understand there'll be a workshop, I think tomorrow or Friday in D.C. during the course of the Congressional Black Caucus about this and other impending kinds of problems. And part of the discussion, I understand, that will take place is the increased level of hostility and anger within Black America. And, you know, people don't take heed to what it is that we say. But anyways, very large, powerful delegation out of Minnesota, many of them arriving on flights this morning, according to reliable sources at in Washington, D.C., if you will. So it's going to be very interesting. But anyway, I just wanted to throw that out.
And I know there was talk of Senator Jeff Hayden heading out there because tonight he actually had a MSURE conference at Lutheran Brotherhood on 24th and Park, which was from 5 to 7 tonight. So I saw that posted by the Minneapolis Urban League, and so I'm pretty sure he'll be zooming out here, if not tonight, first thing in the morning. So
Yeah. Well, he may have already actually left. He may have left this morning with the big delegation headed up by the United States Representative Well, yeah, you know, that's interesting that there was a posting you've got there in front of you that says that on the MSURE stuff. Is that right?
Yeah, there was. Let me just pull it up here on that screen.
Yeah, because I know that Congressman Ellison, Louis King, Al Flowers, and others are, you know, closeted right now in some serious discussions.
Yeah. Don't forget to join Senator Hayden and others tonight at the Lutheran Social Services for the MSURE Town Hall. 6 to 8.
Okay.
Yep. 8 hours ago they posted it, and so that was today, and so they're expecting it tonight.
Okay. Well, he's missing his meeting in D.C. as we speak, if that is correct information. But they will begin a series of meetings and panel discussions and et cetera definitely tomorrow. But some of that is already going on, and hopefully they'll bring back the information, Congressman. And others will enlighten the community on what has happened. I've had a chance to review the itinerary for this 4-day confab, and it's rather interesting, rather interesting across the board. But finishing up, let's give the phone number in case there are any calls on the shootings at the naval shipyards in Washington, D.C. Anyone may have some observations. I think that your initial observations, Don, were rather potent, if you will, that this could be used by the extreme right to indicate that there needs to be a closer monitoring, if you will, maybe even a roundup of young African Americans.
Yeah, that'd be a possibility.
Yeah,
and that's potent. The number here is 347-426-3904. Again, that number is 347-426-3904. Now, Mr. Edwards, I've been working on a story about this Naval Yard shooter, Aaron Alexis, and I think there's a backstory here that hasn't made it to the mainstream media. And this guy, well, I'm looking at all these, the Washington Post, New York Times, and they're saying things like he has a violent criminal history, citing his checkered naval career, the Washington Post, the mental health issues, police report via the New York Times, and how he was arrested in Georgia in 2008 on a disorderly conduct charge, and he spent two nights in jail, Washington Post. And there's
After a fight at a nightclub, right, yeah.
Yeah. And so there are some serious news items coming out about this man. They're just trying to, like, really take him under and portray him, you know, as maybe something he might not be. He might snap. I mean, it's wrong to shoot anybody, period. And you know, the gun could have been a problem. The mental illness could have been a problem. But what I guess what I'm trying to say is that there's a backstory to this that has not come out yet. I don't know what that is.
That's what I was saying earlier, Don. There's more to this. By the way, I mean, for the listening audience domestically and around the world, I mean, he shot, he wasn't biased. He shot and killed both Caucasians and African-Americans. Yeah, number. What troubled me, Don, let me get your take on this. What troubled me was the age of so many of the victims. The average age was about 53 years old. And just a lot of seniors, if you will, a lot of older Americans, many of them former military people, if you will. That was the thing that disturbed me, because when he opened fire from the atrium into the down onto the lunchroom, a lot of people there were having kind of morning breakfast before they began their duties and chores there. And though the president said it was a very cowardly act, and certainly it is, to fire on people who are unarmed, but on the other hand, he engaged fully armed security personnel, killing one, if you will, wounding another seriously, and before he himself was shot, exchanged intense gunfire with D.C. Metropolitan Police officers there in the atrium along those bridges there. So this was a man who, you know, unfortunately came to do business, if you
yes,
will.
He did.
And, yeah,
he did.
And, you know, I'm interested myself because of my long examination of covert operations and et cetera carried out by this country. I'm interested in his portfolio, his travel abroad, if you will. You mentioned you missed one piece. 2004, he was engaged in a situation in Seattle where he shot out the tires on a construction truck of some individuals who he felt were taunting him and threatening him. But what has caught my attention more than anything was the statement by his father that he was involved in the rescue of victims during 9/11. He was going to the New York Manhattan Community College, which was right across the street at that time from the Twin Towers. He was involved in the rescue, and I noticed there's been no repudiation of those statements by his father. And I thought, I'm saddened for everyone, but I thought that the statement that his mother read that was carried on CNN a couple hours ago, I mean, it's just heartbreaking. So, you know, a lot of damage certainly has been done, but it's just like the Boston Marathon situation where you had a gunman who is now deceased, but who Russian security notified the United States that this person should be a person of interest when he went to Chechnya. Disappeared for 10 months inside of Russia, if you will, and came back radicalized, significantly radicalized, and with significant skills in bomb making. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, oh yeah.
And people nearly have not crafted a deep analysis of what really happened. His brother, who of course was seriously wounded in a fierce exchange of gunfire with a suburban Boston Police Department and other security forces, really does not appear to be that helpful, if you will. Then we had the shooting of one of their friends, who apparently was, you know, assassinated really by FBI agents under, while being questioned in Florida. Remember that?
Yep, sure do.
I don't know if you was, if anyone really followed that. People turning to want to kind of forget that, if you will. That was very mysterious. But I'm like you. I'm not sure what the portfolio of Aaron Alexis really is. Who is he really, if you will? We know this. We know that he was in the United States Navy Reserve, and though they say that he had apparently a checkered past and et cetera, he did receive a honorable discharge. He did not receive less than honorable or under conditions or et cetera. And he continued right up to his death, if you will.
Yeah.
He continued to have a significant security clearance.
Yeah, good job, Army contractor. And, Mr. Edwards, we have a call.
All right, let's get it.
A caller, you're live on the air. Go ahead. What's your name?
Good afternoon. Good evening. This is Jamar Nelson. How are you guys this evening?
I'm doing great, sir. How are you?
Real good. What can we do for you?
Well, you know what? The shooting, the mass shooting, kind of brings up something, a soft subject that probably isn't going to happen, but it really brings up the notion that there has to be some type of sensible gun control, or at least a type of mental illness initiative that has to be enacted. Because, again, someone definitely dropped the ball. The state police had notified the Navy that this gentleman had shot out these tires and was, as they call it, out of control, and yet and still...
Well, Miss Nelson, I want to back up there on the shooting out the tires. That he wasn't in the Navy at that time. He was in the Navy from 2007 to 2011. The shooting out the tires happened in Seattle in 2004. I think what you're saying is that the state police of Rhode Island a couple of months ago notified the Navy that there had been an incident in Newport, Rhode Island, where Mr. Alexis began to talk in terms of hearing voices, that people were trying to kill him, and et cetera. That was the contact by the police with the Navy.
Okay. Thank you for correcting me. Don't want to get things screwed up. But, again, that goes back to my point again, Ms. Edwards. Someone dropped the ball. When the state police do their job of notifying who they thought this young man's superior, and yet and still he was able to keep this pistol, keep this gun, keep his weapons, and there was no actions taken, there has to be some type of mental initiative that needs to be enacted. Because if you can keep someone that's mentally unstable away from a pistol, we can not eradicate mass shootings, but you can somewhat curtail some. Because if you think about the last three mass shootings, each individual, yes, sir.
Sir, I got to stop you right there, because you're going on with that liberal craziness about gun control and passing laws. And when the fact is, here's what happens. There is no pre-crime data that says that this person or that person is going to shoot. There's no data that says that, you know, it could have been a 45-year-old white guy who has a squeaky clean record, who's never been in any trouble, to take a pistol and shoot up places. It's the person. It's not the gun. So gun control does, it turns back and it affects, like, you know, the war on drugs, black people, minorities. Gun control, if it's in place, it'll be bad for minorities. Okay?
Right.
And go ahead.
Ron,
go ahead.
The last three cases of the individuals the last three individuals that were identified with these mass shootings, were they not identified to have some type of mental incapacity?
Okay, yes, they were.
How are you going to stop someone
from getting a gun?
Let me answer for you. If the young man who killed his own mom, this young man, and the other young man that shot up the theater, if there was something in their records that these individuals had some type of mental incapacities, they wouldn't, and if there was a law enacted that that limited these guys, eliminated these guys from having weapons, they wouldn't have been able to get weapons. The young man's mom, if there's a law enacted that says that these individuals that have some type of mental incapacities cannot be around them, that young man's mom probably would be living because she would not be able to have weapons around him. This young man that shot and killed these people the other day here, his weapon clearance would have been taken from him.
No. Mr. Nelson, there is laws about having guns. You can't have a gun unless you register it legally, okay? There's a lot of people walking around illegally with guns. More gun legislation will not do anything, okay? Now, number one. Number two, you know, if you look at Adam Lanza, his parents had weapons in the house. The cycle.
Why don't you identify who Lanza? Lanza is the Newtown shooter.
The Newtown shooter had weapons in his house.
Who killed his mother first before he left home? But go ahead.
Jared Lee Longer, who pleaded guilty to 19 charges of murder in connection with the Tucson, Arizona murder, January 8th, where he shot Representative Gabriel Giffords in the head. I mean, he was crazy. But pre-determining his craziness, it wasn't there. He could go in like the next person to get a gun. Like, I could go get a permit to carry. I could go purchase a gun, okay? And so it would be no problem. You can't pin this. You know, mental illness will come out of the box. More money, more programs, more wasting, spending. And it will not do anything because I'm going to tell you something. If someone wants to shoot someone and get a gun, you can get a gun, period.
But let me go back over some. This is Mr. Edwards, Ms. Dell. Let's just take a look at your hypothesis for, gun control and early anticipation. Now, let's go back to Newtown.
Yes.
The Lanza. First of all, we have to remember that there were no signs specifically of any mental duress. But more importantly, it was his mother who bought the guns, and it was his mother who taught him how to shoot. Okay?
And but there was, though.
Beg your pardon?
But there were. He had been seeing a psychiatrist. So there were
there's a lot of people see psychiatrists for a lot of different reasons.
But Mr. Edwards.
But Mr. Nelson,
though,
if you don't indicate. No. If you don't indicate a predisposition to quote unquote do harm to somebody, like in the case of unfortunately Aaron Alexis, where you talk about I'm hearing voices and etc. There is somewhat of a prohibition because the gentleman in Aurora, Colorado, that you also mentioned that shot up the movie theater, he was under direct consultation with a psychiatrist at the University of Colorado up there in Boulder. And, in fact, she was somewhat depressed because she was indicating some problems, but she herself may not have done her professional and clinical job by giving the kind of notification about what this man was saying. But here's the thing, and the documentation has been reviewed during the course of grand jury proceedings in Colorado. She never asked him, nor did anybody else ask him in the Aurora, Colorado situation, did he own any weapons? Okay. Now, what he did, he was buying his weapons through his parents in San Diego, okay, which was actually his home. You have to also understand he was considered to be so brilliant in microchemistry and et cetera that folks were like, well, he is someone who is worthy of consideration and advancement in the society, so we don't want to put a label on him. Now, you're going to hear something different with respect to Aaron Alexis. Because they're going to make it appear that there were all kinds of early warning signals and et cetera. But as you said, certainly these folks have had, there have been early warning signals. Nothing has been done. Let me also go back to just kind of another correction. The shotgun that Aaron Alexis had, he had just bought that a couple of days before at a store in Northern Virginia. And so he was not yet on the grid, if you understand what I'm saying. He had not been identified as a person that one should be suspicious of. He had just bought that weapon. The other long gun that he had, he retrieved that from one of the security personnel that he shot and killed. Okay? So, I mean, I understand what we're all saying, and I understand the frustration, but the fact of the matter is we best understand this. And I thought that it was so ironic that the Capitol was locked down and our congresspersons and lawmakers fled to the deep basements and et cetera, because this is the same Congress that, as, you know, parents of 26 children and, what was it, six teachers who were gunned down in Newtown, Connecticut, went to the Congress, sat in the galleries, met with members of Congress and et cetera to beg them, plead with them to enact legislation. That's the same turned it down.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So,
absolutely.
You know, the whole question is, at what point is there a level of consciousness in this country? I'm not going to use the word guilt. At what point is there a level of consciousness and humanity in this country where folks try to do the right thing? I just don't think the nation is ready to accept it, to accept gun control.
You're right, and that's what I said. You're absolutely right. But let me say this, Dom. That's not liberal talk. This is from a concerned black man that has fed up with gun violence in his neighborhood and in the neighborhoods where his family members live and friends, things of that nature. Again, we cannot totally eradicate gun violence, but if you can convict a felon that's in possession of a weapon, make a database of them, how can you not enact even the simplest law to deem someone that has been deemed incapacitated, how can you not make it some type of law that restricts them from owning a weapon? Listen, you're talking to a gun owner. I'm not trying to take away any of them. That's what some liberals would try to do, take away a gun owner, which I don't believe that to be true either.
How's this, Mr. Nelson, how's this? Okay, let's do this.
Okay.
Let's stop gun violence from 17 to 21-year-olds. Let's start in North Minneapolis, okay?
Okay.
Let's say if a youth is caught with a gun, uses a gun in a crime, but does not kill anyone and does not have a significant criminal background or history, that it is mandatory for him to go into the Marines for 4 years or take an automatic sentence of 5 years in the jail.
We can't ration sentences. When a young man is convicted of an armed robbery or any type of crime like that, heinous crime like that, where it involves a weapon, he needs to serve the time. We need to enforce the laws on the books. If it's five years.
Here's what happens.
He gets a slap on the wrist. That's what happens.
No. The concentration, number one, here's the successful measurable outcomes. 9 times out of 10, it's going to be a minority. It's going to be African-American male. It's going to be Hispanic, okay? And what's been happening what's going to be happening is that those people are going to fill up the jails, okay?
Right.
But we don't want that,
yep.
Okay? Nine out of ten of those gentlemen, male and females, minorities, are living in poverty in Minneapolis,
right.
Okay?
Absolutely.
The military would do would take them out of a situation. Now, if they cut up in the military, they'll be in Fort Leavenworth, okay? But what I'm saying is they could change their dynamics, change their future if something like that was enacted. But I'm telling you, gun violence and people sneaking around shooting and carrying guns would drop significantly if they knew that the penalty would be, this military or this mandatory 5 years in prison.
You guys, you really think that? Do you really think that
no.
A 17, 16, 15, 14-year-old really is that seasoned, has that much intellectual depth to be concerned about that?
Absolutely not. And again, he would relish the fact of killing someone and saying, "Hey man, I'm gonna go over to Iraq and kill somebody else," like an idiot. So if we ration jail, that's what I'm saying. We have to become more stricter. Listen, this isn't Chicago. Hopefully it never becomes. But, again, we're slapping these guys. And I don't care what color you are. If you commit a heinous crime that involves a weapon, you need to serve the full time. We are slapping these first-time offenders on the wrist. And I don't want to sound like a hypocrite, because if you're talking to a gun owner and something involves my gun, and you know. But if I'm handling my gun in the right way, and it's not being used in an act of a robbery, things of that nature, I shouldn't have anything to worry about. But when we're talking about these gang members who get slapped on the wrist, or because the jails are so filled, this felon gets another chance at probation. And then what does he do? He goes out and shoots again. And then he may get another chance. If we take the felons off the streets that are continuously committing these crimes, and if we take the first-time offenders that are using these handguns and guns of any
nature. Well, let me ask you a question, and everything that's being talked about here obviously is of a serious nature, but let me be a little bit more serious, gentlemen, because I just don't think we're really being honest in the discussion with respect to what the broader society, the law enforcement and judiciary, feels about the need to control and to be consistently knowledgeable about what is happening. Let me walk back just a step. What are you going to do in a situation where an individual is carrying out all kinds of heinous acts and et cetera, but actually the system wants him because he is operating as an agent provocateur, a double agent. He is an informant. He is creating mayhem within his community against those in his community, and is allowed to perpetrate upon the streets and the highways and byways of America, as long as he understands what his mission is. How do you address that? Give me your thinking of how you deal. See, I deal with law enforcement, and I was a member for 5 years of the Department of Justice's Oversight Committee of the Minneapolis Police Department. I have to tell you, gentlemen, that there are officers out there, and there are those also involved with the system, be they probation officers and et cetera, that they have been indoctrinated that there has to be a cadre of individuals that must be continuously rotated through the community so, quote-unquote, they can, quote-unquote, fight crime, if you will.
Agree.
And so I've seen in my many years here, over 70 almost, that I've seen a lot of individuals that people didn't have a clue that these persons were agent provocateurs. I really saw it in the days of the civil rights movement of the 1960s. In fact, that's how the Black Panthers were actually destroyed, by agent provocateurs.
Yes.
Some who were criminals, others who were in the military or in police departments and et cetera, who came in, who plotted situations, caused circumstances to take place that brought harm onto the community. And you see, and this has been going on for time immemorial. And so let's say that both of you gentlemen are, let's say you're riding in your car and you guys are pulling up to a cafe and a young cat runs up to you and he puts a 380 on you and he takes your money, busts you upside the head. And by the way, that's happened all the time. So anyway, let's say he's apprehended and it appears the county attorney is saying to you, we want to deal with this character and he's a bad guy and et cetera. And then all of a sudden you find out that he doesn't get any time, okay? And then maybe if you really explore, you find out that this guy has been involved in some pretty peculiar stuff. And then maybe he disappears. And maybe by accident or happenstance, you find out that he's operating somewhere else, that he's no longer in Minneapolis. Maybe he's in St. Louis. Maybe he's in Oklahoma City. How do you challenge the system, gentlemen? How do you challenge the system about these operatives, these agent provocateurs, who the system itself encourages to create mayhem within their Pacific community? I mean, are we prepared to stand up and to confront the system and do the necessary investigation and research to confront the system? What's your thinking, gentlemen?
Well, I'm going to tell you, I'm going to stay in my lane and report news. That's it. Okay? Okay, and as far as confronting the system, if I put myself in a situation where someone does run up on me like that, well, I shouldn't have been in that situation. But you know, there's some there's craziness happening everywhere, every
gentlemen,
day.
Let me say the reason that, and so that our listening audience across the country and here in the Twin Cities, I'm not just giving you a hypothetical. There was a situation here in the period from 2005 to 2007 where the police used a operative to actually destroy the Black Police Officers Association here in the city of Minneapolis.
Oh, right. No.
Yeah, and for those that want to remember and give us a call, many of you know who I'm talking about. And that individual had been an agent provocateur for almost 15 years. He was involved in a beautiful setup of a Black police officer, if you will. The FBI and federal authorities came down on that individual, took no note of the long criminal history of the individual, but it was all a part of a vicious conspiracy inside the Minneapolis Police Department involving white officers against the franchise and the interests of Black officers. Now, a couple of pieces were written about this individual, but do you know that individual is still on the street, still active? In fact, I can take you to a coffee shop on Hennepin Avenue, and he's sitting right in there on his computer, taking care of business. So I just had to raise that question, gentlemen. Brother Nelson, appreciate it. We want to move on now to the situation in the Carolinas, but excellent discussion. Let's reengage next week, okay?
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Yeah. Don, moving to the North Carolina situation.
Yes.
Brother shot 10 times. I mean, and it's a conservative. I mean, can you give me any justification for this? I mean,
I don't have any justification for this at all. You know, and a police officer shooting someone that was unarmed running at you. Okay.
That's what they said. They said that.
Yeah.
Now, what was interesting, there were three officers on scene by the time that this young African-American, 24-year-old African-American there in Charlotte was identified as a possible suspect of whatever it was. I, like many others, listened to the 911 tape. A homeowner who seemed to be a Caucasian was saying that someone seemed to be trying to break in his door. The young man had just been in an accident, saw a picture of his car. He was clearly rear-ended, and he certainly could have been shaken up, if you will. But to shoot him 10 times, now what this does, though, and we haven't touched on that, and we have a responsibility to our local audiences and et cetera, you know, the grand jury completed its charge and responsibility last Thursday in the examination and investigation of T.T. Franklin, a young African-American shot probably 14 times by police in a basement on May 10th, 2013 at 2717 Bryan Avenue South. But I'm just trying to figure out what could have been the conditions that would have caused this officer to fire 10 times. Now, you know he wasn't shooting a little snub-nosed .22 with little .22 bullets. You know he was firing a 9mm. I mean, 10 times, Don. I mean, wow.
Yeah, I'm looking at the story here. This is crazy. You know, just 10 times. I mean, he was dead after probably the first shot. So this was just malice and just a nefarious act for him to even do this.
And I think that's why the prosecutor there in Charlotte had him arrested within 24 hours. Now, his colleagues and comrades in arms are already rallying to him. And if I'm not mistaken, this comes in a city that used to have a Black mayor. I don't know if the past mayor was succeeded by another African-American. But lines are being drawn right now in North Carolina over this shooting. And, in fact, if it had not been for the shootings at the shipyard in Washington, D.C., this would have probably been the primetime story.
Yes.
But you see that they're trying to push it to the back and not have another Trayvon Martin situation, if you will. But I just think your heart has to go out to the – and by the way, this is not a young man who would fit the description of what we were just talking about in the three-way discussion. He was not a perpetrator or perp or a scumbag or all that. He was a graduate of Florida A&M. He had made all-conference in football. He was a young man who, according to everyone that knew him, had his head on right and understood his mission, and yet he's gone. And, you know, we've lost another potential champion, if you will, that could help make a difference in Black America. You know, but
yeah.
I just think we need to know it. Give that number out again, Don, in case there's anybody that wants to call us on Aaron Alexis or the shootings in Carolina or, you know, the whole issue of gun control and putting things in order. And we haven't even talked in terms of Vladimir Putin helping American politicians out, getting them off the diving board with no water in the pool.
Yeah. Yeah, that number is 347-426-3904. Again, that number is 347-426-3904. The phone lines are open, and we are going to be going to 9:30 tonight, that I've just noticed, and let everybody know that.
Oh, so is it 9:30? Okay.
9:30.
Not 10?
Yes. Not 10.
Oh, just 9:30. Okay. I'm glad you happened to mention it. I thought we were going to be rolling to 10. Okay. Go ahead. What else we got?
Well, you know what? I picked up the paper, Mr. Edwards, on Tuesday, and I looked below the fold, the Johannesburg Times, or the Star and Tribune, whatever people like to call it, and it says, Dayton calls for Vikings to pay equitably. He wants to ensure Wolves don't pass on stadium costs. I don't understand, Mr. Edwards, but you've been covering this for more than a couple of years now. How is it that Governor Mark Dayton thinks the Vikings have not contributed to the Vikings?
Well, let me cut into it, Don, in the 17 minutes that we have left on tonight's program. First of all, what we have here is a little bit of subterfuge because and it's in my column in the Minnesota Spokesman Ricardo, the largest black and oldest newspaper here in the state of Minnesota. The state of Minnesota and the city of Minneapolis have a $498 million obligation. The Vikings have, and the Vikings and the NFL have a $477 million. The city of Minneapolis, but more importantly, the state of Minnesota has a $498 million obligation, which brings it to the $975 million, which ultimately will wind up being $1 billion because there will be cost overrun. The governor is trying to keep your attention away from the fact that the state, and I call attention to the copyrighted stories in this morning's edition and the news television programs here during the news hour, that the state does not have anything approaching its obligation. They're talking about selling bonds. They were going to do it with electronic bingo and then electronic pull tabs and then electronic bingo. They've just announced this afternoon that they have garnered a sum total of $0 from electronic pull tabs
and Mr.
to go towards the. Oh, let's get the caller. The caller's always more important. Get the caller. Go ahead.
Oh, you're live on the air. Go ahead.
Oh, are you
Hello?
Talking to me? This is Doug.
Yes, sir.
Jones.
Yeah, you're the caller.
Oh, Doug. Okay, the man that filed suit against the city of Minneapolis for violating the charter. maybe you want to weigh in a little bit here, Doug, on the governor's position that the Vikings should put another $200 million into the coffer. What's your thinking on that?
Well, I think he knew that he signed a sweetheart deal when he made it a year ago. So I don't know, he's suddenly getting cold feet or something. I don't know. I don't know that there's really all that much he can do about it.
And move it along, particularly in light of the fact that our audiences across the Midwest and the country and around the world should know that there is no lease agreement that's been signed. And technically, what Mr. Mann is implying here right now at this very minute is that there is no legal leverage to force the Vikings to do anything and definitely not to force them to stay in Minnesota if this reaches a point where there is that kind of rupture of relationship, okay?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And so going back to, you know, giving you an opportunity, Doug, as a man who has certainly raised the question about violation of, you know, constitutional sovereignty in the case of the Minneapolis City Charter, I just don't know where the city of Minneapolis, but more importantly the state, I don't know where they're going to get their $498 million from. Was this ever asked of you by the court during your oral arguments a month ago?
No, that didn't come up. And the judge doesn't want to get himself very much entangled in deciding whether the legislature overstepped any boundaries.
Okay.
He wanted me to tell him if there is a way that he could rule that the city violated the charter, and that it was the primary
okay.
actor.
Well, let me say this again for our listening audience. And Mr. Mann was with us a couple of weeks ago and laid out in a very articulate manner his lawsuit and motions filed before the district court here in Hennepin County, where the city of Minneapolis is located and where the stadium is located. And we had a very good discussion with Mr. Mann about the fact that, yeah, Judge Bush really wants to kind of stay away from that. But, it's clear to me, as a longtime constitutionalist, that the leverage that he needs to rule in favor of your petition, if you will, is contained within the language of the charter, which indicates that there has to be a referendum for anything over $10 million. And the city is on the hook for $150 million, and it's written right in the legislation, $150 million. That's a whole lot more than $10 million, okay? And the city council, on a 7-6 vote, chose to ignore the rules of their own charter, if you will, and went ahead on that 7-6 vote to indicate that there would be no referendum and that the newly created Metropolitan Sports Authority could move ahead with negotiations and et cetera. But people are paying no attention, Mr. Mann, to the fact that there is no lease agreement. There is no lease for the Vikings to play in the People's Stadium.
Well, one of the problems they're having, too, is that with this writ of mandamus as yet undecided, there's some potential risk there. If the judge should grant the writ and compel the city council to order a
special election,
a referendum, mm-hmm. yeah, in a special election, or possibly sneak it onto the ballot real quick. That's a problem. The city council has argued that the legislature gave them permission to violate the charter, and that's basically the issue that Judge Bush is going to have to probably weigh in on. And it's actually a very complicated issue, involving the limitations of power of the legislature and so forth. But I don't, I don't see how that's going to, hold water. Now the thing is Bush could rule one way or the other, or he could potentially just sit on it indefinitely. I don't know.
Okay. All right. All right, Mr. Mann, appreciate you calling in. Appreciate it, man. Thank you, and continue to pursue and follow that lawsuit that you have filed, being one of the more courageous individuals to challenge the city council's violation of its own doctrine of governance, the city charter. Thank you. Appreciate it. All right.
You bet. I'll talk to you
all
next time.
All right. Great. Take care.
Thank you.
All right. Yeah. Go ahead, Don. Anything on this?
Just,
any other calls? Let's get that number out there. Maybe there's a couple other people that want to find out more about if their beloved Vikings are going to be here for the 2014 season.
Yeah, let's just kiss and say goodbye, Minnesota Vikings. The number is 347-426-3904. Again, that number is 347-426-3904. I think, that this thing is laid out because, the state legislator erred in its assertion that the city of Minneapolis, based on the local option sales tax revenues, are not a city resource within the meaning of the charter or any other law. Okay, and so as a consequence, the legislators directive to the city council of Minneapolis City Council not to refer the approval of the Viking Stadium Act to the voters in the referendum exceeds their constitutional authority under Article 12, Section 2, for the reason given in the preceding paragraph, but also Article 12, Section 4 of the Minnesota Constitution, which invests local governments with the power to adopt home rule charters that may require referendums under specific circumstances. The city of Minneapolis charter has two provisions that restricts the city's ability to incur debt and use city resources to pay for stadium or professional sports facilities without voter approval. Mr. Mann,
for the purpose of transparency and clarity, you are reading from the Minneapolis City Charter?
Yes, I am.
Okay, that's good. So that people know the where the information is flowing from. Go ahead.
Actually, this is the Viking Stadium Act, Chapter 299 of the 2012 legislative session laws. And it's specific. It just tells them that no, you cannot do that. The people of Minneapolis have to vote. It is mandatory. So you cannot the state legislature cannot say, okay, Minneapolis, just go ahead and let's do this, roll this together without engaging the voters. Period. And the law is clear. The law is clear. I think this is significant because I think Doug Mann, mayoral candidate for Minneapolis, Doug Mann has did a great service for the citizens of Minneapolis, and I think that they need to support him in any way they can in this particular instance, because if the judge rules in his favor, all hell's going to break loose downtown.
And what will happen, the city of Minneapolis and the state of Minnesota will ask for an accelerated appeal process, and this will shoot right up through the Court of Appeals, and if they don't rule favorably, straight to the Supreme Court. In fact, actually, there is a portion in the provision that talks in terms of the exact role of the state Supreme Court if there's issues of litigation, quote-unquote, and jurisdictional disputes and et cetera, that this matter actually goes straight to the state Supreme Court. Here in the state of Minnesota, we have district courts, and then we have the Court of Appeals, and then we have the state Supreme Court. I've been watching for quite some time how that's going to be maneuvered, particularly in light of, and kind of get your thoughts here, Don, in the 6 minutes we've got left, on the People's Plaza. That was going to be the big development piece that the Star Tribune was going to probably make upwards of $100 million on, certainly a minimum of $75 million. Ryan Construction was brought in. Some city officials who are going to be leaving the city council were going to get jobs as employees of the development project. I don't know where that's going at this point. What are you hearing, Don? Are you hearing anything?
Well, I don't think that this is going to happen, Mr. Harris, but I just keep going back to the main thing. All this court stuff, if Judge Bush decides, Judge Bush is the judge, in Doug Mann's favor, then everything is kind of on hold, and which means that the Vikings have another open window and an open door. They can choose which way they want to go out. And the Star Tribune has, I mean, you can't get the Star Tribune to be honest about anything, you know, and you're looking at, you know, something about this, the money that they're going to make, because they're going broke, and they're not reporting, they're biased, they're not objective anymore in this whole stadium issue, and they're excluding the facts. Also, WCCO, just let's throw some mainstream media in there, is doing the same thing. And so how are the people of Minneapolis even going to know what's going on in a year, election year, with 35 mayoral candidates and attention's being drawn to the ones that have raised the most money? But unfortunately, the ones who raise the most money will not be the ones who win. Trust me on that. I'm predicting that today.
Yeah. One of the things we don't want to omit, and maybe I'm going to make a suggestion here over the air that we may want to do, we may want to invite Alex Tittle, the equity director for the Sports Facility Authority. Mr. Tittle hired into that position about 2 months ago. Because we're not hearing a lot of discussion anymore about all of the black folk that were going to go to work on the stadium. And I'm going to suggest that we send a telegram, actually, to Mr. Tittle, asking him to join us on the air next Wednesday to kind of give us his read on how safe, if you will, how firm is the commitment to equity and diversity and affirmative action and et cetera on the stadium. Because I keep hearing people say, and we had this in the production meeting this morning, Don, they keep talking about construction will start in November on the stadium.
No way.
What kind of construction? Where? The stadium, you can't do anything around the stadium until the season has concluded. And right now at 0-2, this team is probably on the road to an 0-5 start. But anyways, you can't do anything until the demolition has been done and the area has been cleaned out and you start the construction. And so I keep hearing this. So my question to Mr. Tittle and others is, okay, so where's the plan? How many African Americans do you have ready to go to work, okay, in mid-November? Yeah, so that's something that we're certainly going to work on, Don, to get that request to Mr. Tittle if the Sports Facility Authority will authorize him to come on the Don and Ron show.
Yeah, I think that we should. That's a great idea, Mr. Edwards, and I'm going to send out an email actually tonight. But also, let's see if we can't get Louis King on the air with him. I'm gonna send a proposal request because I think that we need to straighten some things out with Mr. King, and it was long overdue, and we'll really promote that show so it'll be evident that they'll be worried. Because
let's also do this. Let's ask Mr. Tittle, to a lesser degree, Mr. King. Let's ask them if they will share the list with us of the 15 organizations that initially made the request for $2.5 million in training money on the Viking Stadium that was turned down by Michelle Kalm-Haglund and the Sports Facility Authority. I'd like to know who those organizations were, because the $2.5 million in training money, I mean, as far as I can remember, since the days of insurrection and et cetera, we have allegedly been training African Americans and others to take on these highly skilled positions and jobs. And I'm not understanding, if we've done all this training, how come we don't have these people ready to go to work? So hey, let's serve notice to them now. We're going to invite them all.
And Mr. Edwards,
go ahead.
So I get that right? There was a list of 15. You're saying list of 15.
It was in my column of 4 weeks ago. Not the group, because that has not been published. But those 15 organizations are known to Mr. Tittle and the Sports Facility Authority. Like to know who they are.
Well,
I know that one of the principal persons was Alfred Babington Johnson of Stair Step.
Oh my God, him again! You know, if you guys want to find out about Stair Step Foundation, Google Stair Step Foundation. Stair Step is one word together, Stair Step Foundation. And look three notches down and play that video. That'll give you Stair Step Foundation in a nutshell. So,
all right. Well, we're down about to the last minute and a half. Don't know much more than we could talk about. Like we said, the phone lines have continuously been open. A lot of primetime issues going on here, but right now the big policy decisions are being made in Washington, D.C., as the Congressional Black Caucus meets and confers.
Yes.
Hey, Mr. Allen, it's been a pleasure.
What's that, excuse me?
I said it's been a pleasure.
Yes, it has. We'll see you next Wednesday.
Okay.